Today's episode is brought to you by Oak Tree Products, the ultimate one-stop shop for audiologists, hearing professionals, and sound professionals. If you're looking for diagnostic or screening equipment, this is the place for you. From the essentials to the hard-to-find tools, Oak Tree has you covered. We've personally been ordering from them for years, and they've always come through. We recently just ordered new diagnostic equipment for four offices through Oak Tree.
During the pandemic, when supplies were hard to come by and everything was up in the air, Oak Tree kept things in stock and moving. They've handled supply chain disruptions, tariff uncertainty, all of it without missing a beat. Whether you're outfitting a new practice or just need to stock up, check them out at oaktreeproducts.com. Again, that's oaktreeproducts.com. We will link to them in the episode description and tell them we sent you when you visit oaktreeproducts.com. Today on Hear Us Out, we're joined by someone who lives at the intersection of psychology, storytelling, and global impact. Dr. Rod Berger is more than a clinical psychologist. He's a communication architect, a Forbes contributor, a podcast host, and a globetrotting interviewer who's shared conversations with some of the most well-known people on the planet. Rod's work has been featured in numerous publications, including a new book titled The Narrative Edge, and his mission is clear: to elevate the stories that shape our world. In this episode, we'll dive into the power of narrative, the psychology behind influence, and why stories are the real currency of leadership and change. Whether you're an educator, executive, creative, or simply a curious mind, you're in for a thoughtful, wide-ranging conversation that just might change how you tell your own story. Welcome to Hear Us Out, Dr. Rod Berger.
Thank you, Dr. Eric, Dr. Michelle. Nice to be here. I appreciate it.
All right. So oftentimes we like to try and start with a big question and to try and keep it in our area a little bit.
All right.
Why don't you tell us your thoughts on the idea of the spoken story, the spoken narrative versus the written word and the written narrative, and how they influence the receiver of the story?
So, okay, I love that question. One, just to be clear with people, and especially in the profession, I'm sure we can talk about this, but I'm not licensed as a clinical psychologist. That's my old world. So I just want to be clear and be respectful of the profession in that regard. So I love that question because in that world that I worked in psychology years ago, there were, you know, I worked with kids and kids on the autism spectrum. I worked with kids, all backgrounds. I worked in schools and clinics. And I will tell you that when I was thinking about your podcast, and I was actually thinking about sort of that variance between the written word and the spoken word and the impact on the recipient. I love the power of audio, but I love it because it feels a little bit like jazz, and you might think that I play music, but I don't. Maybe in another lifetime. But what I love about the exchange when it comes to audio is it's not just sort of me speaking or either of you speaking. I feel that there's a dance, right? Sort of the steps, in between the steps are the pauses, where we can really think about sequence and tone and the way in which we are trying to convey a message. So I've always been an absolute lover of audio and the power of being able to communicate a message in that regard. And I've seen professionals like yourselves do some incredible work with people to help assist in these areas. So, you know, I'm just selfishly, I'm a big fan of what you do in the profession because I think it's, you know, it's easy to take it for granted.
For sure.
But boy, I will tell you this, that in writing my book and being very lucky to travel around the world, when you're put in environments where you are not, it's not what you're used to, right? Whether it's, you know, I'm the only white face in an environment, or I'm in an environment where they don't speak the language, you really, the power of audio, the power of hearing and listening to other people, even if you don't know what they're exactly saying because of the language, you don't want to get lost in translation. And so understanding the power of the pause in that regard, I think just literally amplifies however you do communicate. So I think it's really powerful. And I will tell you that when I write, it's a long way of saying when I write, I'm listening to movie scores 24/7. In fact, I'm a little neurotic about it. If I get into a zone and I hear one and I'm sort of in a good jet stream of thought, all day on repeat. So if anything, I have my relationship to audio and the written word is, I mean, they're synonymous with one another. I couldn't do it without it.
How do you compensate when you are in these spaces that are not necessarily your wheelhouse, whether it's topic, whether it's language barrier or something else? What are your compensatory strategies to make yourself feel like it is in your wheelhouse, even if you're faking it?
So what a great question, Dr. Michelle. So I'll give you an example. So I was just saying off air that just a little bit jet lagged. I just got back from 2 weeks in the Nordics. I was on stage with climatologists and all these amazing people in Stockholm, Sweden. And then I hosted the inaugural Nordic Climate Finance Summit. And I guarantee you, in both rooms, both environments, I was not nearly the smartest person in the room. Not that that's a goal. But why I love that question, Dr. Michelle, is because, you know, people a long time ago used to ask me, like, well, why do you interview people? I've done over 4,000 interviews. Like, why don't you just focus on one group? Well, for me, this goes back to my roots in psychology. As human beings, we're not just one thing. And I knew that when I was going through my training and all my clinical experiences, that I was better in the moment if I wasn't going in saying, like, sort of, I'm that guy, right? I can do this. Now, in psychology, I would get dumped into that because there were a lot of clinics where there were very few men. And we have that in education as well. So I had to adapt. But what I do, Michelle, Dr. Michelle.
Michelle is fine.
Eric.
No, what I do, guys, is that I try to maintain curiosity. Because if I'm curious, I find that I can be deferential to whoever that person is or that environment, because I'm not coming in trying to be the expert. I know what I'm an expert in. I'm an expert in being curious, maybe to a fault sometimes, channeling my family, right? If I get annoying because I'm curious about things. But I do think in professional settings, it allows me to come into a situation and acknowledge that I don't have your expertise. I may have something on the margins just because I pay attention, or I'm a news junkie, or just I love information and learning. But that doesn't mean that I can come in and sort of circumvent what you're doing and your skill set. So I really try to be curious, because when I was just doing this and was on stage last week in Oslo, there was no way that I could come across as that wasn't my job or my role. So it's really it's freeing, Michelle, because I don't have to, there's no faking it. You know, that's the beauty of it, in being curious.
It's such an interesting perspective that you share there, because I think a lot of times people don't even realize they're undermining themselves when they're trying to prove their knowledge in an area where maybe they're not the expert, or somebody like in the situation you're describing in Oslo, somebody's going to know more on a specific topic than you do. Why try and compete with that? Learn from that. And I feel like so many interactions that people have, curiosity is missing. And you're speaking to the importance of curiosity. And we know there's research to back up the idea that if you want to make yourself seem interesting, ask somebody questions, ask somebody about themselves. So tell us about how you feel like curiosity is either misunderstood or ignored in a way that's really detrimental for communication.
Yeah, So one, I think this sounds bad, but it can be used strategically as as sort of a tool that you have, right? Because if you go in and you're like, I just want to be curious about this. To your point, Eric, people, they love to talk about themselves. We're humans, right? This is just, it's natural to want to talk about the things that we're interested in. But I think the reason why it can be hard sometimes for people is because if you're really going to be curious, you have to be a really good listener. Like, that is key. Like, it's not that someone's going to be sort of called out for being a fraud. That's an extreme. But if I'm trying to convey that I'm being curious, and then I miss the very first thing you say, or I'm not engaged in a follow-up, then that's just telling me that I'm not listening, you know? I think most of us have been in situations where someone is talking, they need to get something off their chest. And I don't mean in a clinical setting, just your friends, you're at the grocery store, soccer field, whatever it is. You don't even say much, but you are conveying that you're really paying attention. You're listening to them. And they might say, I just love talking to you. And you're thinking, well, that's great, because I didn't say a thing. And that's amazing that somehow there was value in my presence, my physical presence. So I think for a lot of people, it does force us to be, we have to be honest that we're, in essence, we're exchanging our time for yours in that moment, right? I'm saying, Michelle, I'm going to give my time to you. And whatever happens is in this exchange, I'm here to listen, right? And I think that that's really powerful. I mean, I go back, people will say to me, like, what do you miss about psychology and working with people one-on-one, or in group settings, or couples or families? You know, the little things. Like, I remember being surprised when there was one time I was working with a young woman, and I just offhandedly, in our regular weekly sessions, made some comment as if something like I had thought about her when I was at some store, something that was connected to her world. And that meant the world to her, because she was being thought of when she wasn't there. So our needs are so basic in that way that I think that if you can be curious and listen in the moment, whether you don't have to say anything or have an answer. Like, you know, Eric, that sometimes men, we get accused of that. Like we're trying to solve something when that's not what we're being asked. Being asked to participate in the physical space or over the phone or something like that. I think we just have to get over that first barrier where we can at least prove that we are genuinely curious. And if we do that, then a really fun story can unfold together where you're co-authoring something. And that's where I think relationships start. Not even romantic relationships, just friendships, you know, collegial sort of relationships, parent-child relationships. It's really important in that space. Sometimes it's what we don't say that makes the biggest impact.
I was just going to say, I think in the context of what you're saying, relationship and connection are intertwined, that in referencing bringing up something that being somewhere that makes you think of a person, there's connection within that because they weren't there. You thought of them. You let them know they were important enough for you to think about in a moment unrelated to them. I think that speaks to the idea of human connection and that it's such an important thing that people oftentimes overlook.
They overlook it. And I think in today's day and age where, I mean, not even talking politics, but across the globe, we are in a me society. I think, civilization. And the danger in that is that we feel more and more isolated. And what happens is, it's, you know, I talked about this. I was sharing this with my daughter on the way to school today. She wanted to know more about what I had done on stage. And I said, because she's a fifth grader and she's going to run for student council and these sorts of things. And we're going to work on her speech tonight. And I just said, you know, I said, honey, sometimes you get in situations where you don't have time to write a script. Like you have to sort of react and respond to the energy in the room, to your friends, to teachers, whatever it is that you're doing. And so I shared with her when I was in Oslo, the organizers, and this goes, it's a very cultural thing over there, which is very interesting to me. And I wrote in my book, it's very deferential when it comes to like, you know, being boastful there. That's the opposite. That's sort of antithetical to that part of the world. And I talked about there was a Holocaust survivor and Nobel Prize laureate, Elie Wiesel, who was awarded in 1986, who survived the Holocaust and said during his acceptance speech that the opposite of love isn't hate, it's indifference. And so I think in a world where it's me, we struggle to then find a place that is anything but indifference or apathy. Because I think if we really think about it, it's like, well, who's really going to care what my opinion is?
In talking about the me society that we're in. Usually when we talk about AI, we do it a little bit later on in the podcast, but it made me think that people are now substituting real people for ChatGPT instead. And they're having these back and forth conversations with AI. And I feel like it facilitates that me because you're not actually hearing another person share an anecdote about themselves or give personalized advice or thoughts. How do you think that AI is influencing communication, storytelling, and how can we possibly overcome that? I don't know if there's a way to put a stop to it.
So it's a good question, Michelle. I'll share a little sort of inside baseball. It's not that inside baseball, but I didn't know. So part of being lucky, just the world that I live in and being around people that are really brilliant and smart, I get to have conversations with people that I don't think I would otherwise have. And so as an example, I was in Oslo and in between the event and these different things, I got to meet this individual who was a part of a very significant robotics company. And we were talking, and this goes to your question about AI and these sort of conversations and sort of what is authentic or synthetic communication. And there are robots that are the size of humans. They've already sold, I think it was 10,000 in the state of California. 100,000 sales already in 2026 have been ordered. And they're so good. They can vacuum your house. They can empty the dishwasher, fold your clothes. They can sit with your grandparent that has dementia and watch TV with them and talk with them. Or there was one example where the one individual's mother-in-law was from Kenya and loved news coming out of Kenya. Well, that robot, guess what it's doing? Sits with her every night and has a conversation with all the updated news. And this is the interaction that she's having. And so I think it's interesting because people will say, oh, that's coming down the road. No, It's here. And so I like the question, Michelle, because it does force us to think about, like, how are we going to maintain our authenticity? Or even just, it's almost like saying, prove to me that you're a human, Eric, right? I mean, what they're doing with these robots, and they're only getting better. I mean, this one, all the number of joints, and I mean, it's soft to the touch. Like, it just, everything about it is as human as you could imagine at this point, and it's just getting, right? So you think, okay, in a world, just for an exercise, where I had to prove that I was human, and not just some, you know, semblance of myself in some, you know, robot form, I think I'd have to do it through story. I'd have to do something that would allow either the nonverbal or the verbal to sort of be expressed in a way that was engaging, was historical and observational too. But I don't even know. Even as I say that, I think it's already probably going to be passing us in that regard. So I don't know if there's a great answer for it, but I do say that I would say that I'm pleasantly surprised at the number of sectors that are talking about the need, the necessity for storytelling. Like McKinsey came out with a report a couple of weeks ago and said CEOs have to be the chief storyteller, like full stop. And if they're not, they're going to sink. And so that's, you know, for me, selfishly, that's great. When you write a book about authenticity and storytelling, that doesn't hurt. But I think, and I don't know how much or how involved you guys are in AI, but I'm in it all the time, every day, either reading something, listening to a podcast with experts, watching something, sort of playing around on my own with it, you know, to see just what it does or its capabilities. Because, you know, Mark Cuban says, if you're not in it every day, like you're going to fall behind.
Yeah.
Like immediately. And I do believe that. So I don't know where it's going to take us. And I don't know if we can contemplate what it even, like the scope, right? Can we contemplate the scope of it, Michelle? I don't know. Because, you know, the one thing that I was listening to is so powerful. They said something like Oppenheimer, right? So the atomic bomb. It took like 5 years and 50 Nobel Prize winning minds to put all that together. And right now we already have a million, like a sort of equivalent, a million Nobel Prize winning minds running 24/7. Right now, today.
Yeah.
And so you just kind of say, I don't even know, like the assumption that we would be able to overcome it would mean that we have something above it, you know, in our capabilities. And I just don't know if that's even true. So it maybe the inverse is it forces us to have conversations with each other. Maybe.
It's an interesting idea, thinking about how technology and conversation and storytelling all intertwine at the same time that we're being told our ability to focus is being squashed by things like reels and the 5 to 8 second stimulation that we need to receive to keep our attention for that little bit of time. At the same time, podcasts are proliferating everywhere, which are generally longer form conversations that, even though we're two-dimensional right now, it becomes a much more interactive process than other technology is. So it's like we're seeing both ends of the spectrum. We've had interesting conversations with musicians where they talk about the idea of needing a clip to get somebody's attention, but also wanting to write the full song. Can you talk about that in the context of storytelling in your work, of how do you capture attention with your ideas and hold on to that for the longer form of the idea?
Wow. It's a quest of an answer that I'm on. I'll kind of frame it this way in what I believe. For quite some time over the last 20 years, we've been hearing, oh, shorter content. It's got to be shorter. It's got to be shorter. I never bought into that because I would see signs in different parts of sort of society where I see lots of long form, whether it's a podcast, something from an audio perspective, or it's written, and all these book clubs and these different, and I'm like, no, I think people still like that. So one is, I don't, just as a general rule, it could change tomorrow. I'm going to kind of do me, right? And I think that if I do sort of what that means to me to just tell the story the way that I think warrants it, whether it's 5,000 words or it's a 30-second script over the top of some video, I'm more about that moment and what I think, where you just like, no, that's what it needs to be. Now, I'm a huge movie buff. And so it makes me think of like directors or people out there. It's like, no, sorry. It needs to be, you know, The Irishman needs to be 3.5 hours or over that. You know, people are like, no, you can't have a movie that's that long, right? We love Pacino and De Niro, but we can't do that. Well, guess what? Scorsese says that's what he needed. So I don't I don't kowtow to sort of that notion of what is the awe from the audience's perspective. I think I do justice by them, my own authenticity around that, around the content. That to me is really, really key, because otherwise I feel like it's just this pendulum that's just either going to make me nauseous or disinterested, you know, or indifferent about producing the content. I think that the evolution of the podcast is fascinating, because now we're seeing all these sort of micro media outlets, right, where they're going, we're leaving all the networks, or we're leaving the cable networks, and we're just going to do our own thing. And so people are consuming their news in all these different ways. I just think it's kind of a natural next step when you're in a world where everything is sort of on your phone, you know. Mm-hmm. And lastly, I would say that when I changed my writing style, I'd been writing with Forbes in these different places and feeling like I was writing to what was expected. I was arriving in Senegal for the first time on the continent of Africa. And I'm looking down as we're starting our descent to land. And I just had this, I was looking down at a landscape I've never seen in my life. And I thought, for whatever reason, I thought, you know what? I'm so tired of doing writing or producing content that I think you want. I'm going to do what I want. And so I started journaling every day when I traveled to Africa. I just put it out like on Facebook, public, whatever, you know, and I just wrote what I wanted to write. And the response was great. And I got notes from people all over the world that I have never met. So it was hitting a nerve where people were saying, you know what, sometimes I do want to, you know, it dates me and it's an old adage, but like stop and smell the roses. And so my writing, I think of it as rhythmic in that way. I want to take you on this sort of magic carpet ride in each chapter, where in this book, you can go with me to a refugee camp in Africa. You can go behind the scenes at Formula One. You can be inside the octagon with the MMA Hall of Famer Habib. I want to take you so that you see how pliable a story is in our life. It's everywhere. It's not just something you're adding. It's not a topping for your ice cream. It's not. It's not a buffet. This is not, that's not what we're doing. Stories everywhere. And so that's really what, you know, for me, that's the power of not worrying about the audience, that if I just do my best, that audience will follow. And I think it's a zero-sum game. I know so many younger people that have like, oh, Rod, I'm so worried about audience. And, you know, how long should I write this? And I'm like, I can't fathom losing sleep over that.
You're never going to please everybody. So you might as right? well do something that pleases yourself.
That's right.
Now, you've conducted thousands of interviews. When we're preparing for the podcast each week, we think, how much of it should we go in prepared or interview ready? And how much of it is going to be gradual, organic, on the fly is another way to say it. How do you go about that? How much of it do you feel like is planned and scripted and ready to go versus you come up with it as you go, see where it takes you?
So love that question, Michelle. So I am a child of Star Wars. So that whole, you know, like trusting in the Force kind of a thing. I used to in the very beginning, you know, of course, I never like when adults act like they were just born professional, you know, whether it was at university or wherever. And you're like, no, I think you probably were 18 and you didn't have it figured out either. But so I didn't have it figured out either. I did have obviously years and years of training in clinical psych. And my specialty was in forensics. So questions and digging in, that was a part of sort of my DNA. So I sort of had that at the ready. But in the beginning, I would do a podcast, like, let's say, you know, one a week or something like that. I mean, I would, if I had 10 days, I would prep for 10 days. I mean, it, you know, I just felt like I could, oh, I don't want to miss an opportunity. And then one day something happened where something changed and I was asked to conduct a podcast like within an hour, you know, and I was forced to just jump in, like literally look at someone's LinkedIn page for about 30 seconds and get on the video and start this podcast, you know? And so for me, when like I had a lot of people who ask me, right? So I'll talk with people who are podcasting these sorts of things or whatever it is they're interviewing. And I just tell them, you know, look, be yourself in that moment, react to what you're getting, because no matter what comes out of it, it's going to be positive. And at least the guest will have an experience that then they will go and recommend you as a host or a host, because it felt like there was this sort of, again, going back to jazz or ping pong or something like that, where it's just a natural organic back and forth. So I don't. Now, what I didn't go from zero to 60. I would take a blank piece of paper, just two lines making four squares, and I might write one word in each square, knowing that those are four sort of thematic areas I'm curious about. I don't have the answers to, so there's nothing scripted. And I just, as we're talking, as I'd be interviewing, I would know, okay, that top left quadrant is this or whatever. And I would just do a check mark. So I don't know the sequence or whatever. But when I'm all done, I'd look and go, yep, okay. That's what I was curious about. And you do that over time, and you just, I think what I love about that approach, Michelle, is it makes you trust yourself and your voice. And that's something we don't ever talk about. Like, can we trust our voice? Can we trust that we're represented? Can we trust the role that we play in the story at home versus the role that we play in the story at work or with our friends? Because we don't typically play the same role, right? You might play like a blowhard at work and you're sort of bossing people around or whatever it is. But at home, you're deferential to your spouse or your loved ones in a way that there's this sort of swinging back and forth, right? So I think that it's important to be able to trust your voice and know, like, you know what? I'm going to ask something that's interesting. And that's the only goal I have actually in an interview. It's not like I don't write it down. But if someone says, you know, I've never been asked that, in my head, I go, okay, that means in essence, I honored them and myself. And it just happened we were live in front of an audience in over another country, and thank goodness it happened, right?
I think
so. Yeah, no formulaic approach to it.
I think that speaks to a lot of how we prepare here, is that we'll listen to our guests in other formats and other places to learn what we don't want to ask. If that answer's out there, it's already out there.
Yeah.
So,
and to my point, Eric, on that one, sorry, real quick, because I love that. I will tell people say, oh, hey, Rod, could you do a story on this? Or would you contemplate doing this or that? I tell them all the time, look, if I can read it in a press release, I'm not talking about it.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. That's my basic rule. If I'm working with high schoolers right now on how to interview, if you can find it in a press release, don't ask me. You might want to dive into the behind the scenes of that just to sort of illustrate that you understand where I'm coming from or something like that. But do not, you know, just that's lazy to me. You know, that's AI.
What point in your career do you feel you've begun to trust your voice?
Well, it's a funny thing, because I think that if you get to the point where you, in essence, you could say like, I trust my voice, you're susceptible to missing, right? You sort of like, wow, I didn't see that. I thought it was going to be the curveball. Man, they threw a fastball right by me. So I think that it's one of those sort of like healthy anxiety levels, right? Like before you go on stage, where there's just enough to propel you to be as engaged and on as you can be. And then I think, look, I look at everything as an at-bat, like in baseball. And I'm not even a huge baseball fan. I'm a big sports fan, but not baseball. Every experience I've ever had, I just think of it as an at-bat, so that I can look back. I can literally look back and go, okay, this is stressful, but I have been, you know, I've had all these at-bats, you know, and I've got to be able to lean into that. Last year, this is sort of an extreme example. I was in Stockholm, and I was helping to host a research seminar. There was members of the royal family there, United Nations, all these powerful people. That was stressful enough, because you just want to, you know, I was probably the only American in the room. Like, I just want to represent well and sort of do my thing. That was at the beginning of the week. And at the end of the week on that Friday was going to be the big gala. Well, anybody who knows Stockholm, like Stockholm gala, I mean, that's saying something, right? They're known for these kinds of things. Well, like 24 hours before that, and I was just supposed to attend, right? Like just enjoy it and then fly home. The host got in an accident on one of these scooters, and he was okay, but he couldn't host. And so they asked me, could you host this gala? I'd never done that before, right? And so I talk about trusting voice. It was like, okay, I can't be what I'm not. So I'm going to be me. And I'm going to be exhausted. And so I was, and I took some chances, but everything I did was sort of me. Anyone who knew me, they're like, okay, that makes sense. And so, but I had to, and that is sort of a monumental moment of trusting my voice, because otherwise I would have been susceptible to what I thought they would expect, trying to match something culturally. And then that's when it goes, I think, off the rails.
And in all the time you've spent conducting interviews and with people who were at the top of their field and well-known and recognized within their professions, was there a point for you, and it's similar to the idea of trusting your voice, but where you felt like a player, you felt like it should be you sitting down with that individual as opposed to the imposter of like, wait a second, how did I get here? How did this come to be? Was there a point for you where it was just like, yep, I'm in the chair I should be in?
I mean, a couple of moments come to mind. I mean, I will endlessly be like amazed like a little kid. I can't believe I just talked to this, what they've accomplished and whatever. And then his friends will say, okay, why don't you just expect that? Like, this is the stuff you've been doing. So why are you just amazed on a Monday that you're talking to this person or whatever? But I have had moments where I'm not the only one there. And you it's human nature. You just try to compare. It's like, you know, Habib, the MMA Hall of Famer. I'm not a mixed martial arts guy or whatever, but I, you know, knew who he was. He's an incredibly famous guy and accomplished fighter. When I was there, there was another guy there from another publication. One, I knew that I was there and getting in the octagon on camera with him because it was my idea to his people and they loved it. And that's why that happened. And they were like, well, we should have more people, you know, let's have a few people come in here and interview him. And I just remember that I went ahead and this guy was, you know, younger than me. He was a little cocky, right? You know, he was there. He's a big time writer in MMA, right? And so they said, all right, who wants to go first? I was like, no, you go for it, man. Deferential to him. And it didn't go well. It did not go well because he didn't read the room. And he's focused on stuff that I think was just very surface level, kind of that press releasey, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of thing. Not a really a term, press releasey.
Let's coin it.
And so when I got in there, I felt like, you know what? No, I'm the one that belongs here in that regard. But I also, on the flip side of that, you know, Eric, it's his story. It's not my story, right? Habib's. And so I don't have any ownership of that. So that is kind of it was a very fleeting thought in the moment. I mean, it did feel good to go, you know, my instincts were right. They gave me all the things we couldn't talk about, but he ended up talking without me even asking. And he smiled and laughed and they couldn't believe that that happened because that's just not sort of his personality. And we've got information where he talked about things that had nothing to do with fighting. And those clips went viral because his people were like, we had no idea. Like, this is sort of the essence of him as a man, as a dad, as a husband, right? As a fighter. And so, yeah, there've been some moments here and there where you think about like, no, I know that I should be here. But I also think that if I lose that, if I lean into that, I lose that. I hope that I would lose the vulnerability and I think my curiosity would not come across as authentic. So I don't ever want to be in a place where I just think, well, no, I'm the best one for it. It's different, right? Like if the three of us interview the same person, you know, they're going to share different things based on the way in which we engage with them. So it's really, you know, I have to be that way. I'd probably enjoy it a lot more. It'd be a lot more fun if I just felt like, yeah, I'm the one, you know, but I don't think that would serve me in the long run.
We talk about it like with a healthy dose of skepticism. You want to be confident,
yeah,
but have a healthy dose of skepticism to make sure you're not missing something or losing something along the way.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean
not insinuating that this has happened, but we've definitely had times with patients, or at least I certainly have, I should not speak for Eric, where I'm having not necessarily an interview, but a dialogue with a patient where I'm digging myself in a hole and whatever I'm intending to say is not how it's coming across. And then I have to find my way out and dig out of that. Have you ever been in a situation like that where whatever you're intending, your intended message is not what is being received? And how do you reframe and also not let it ruin your mindset for the remainder of the interview?
So I didn't know we were talking about marriage, but okay. No, my first reaction to that is that over time, I have learned that if something is met in that regard, right, where you just feel like, gosh, I'm for whatever reason, I'm missing the mark or they're not hearing what I'm intending. I try to think about, in essence, all right, was I wrong on the timing of this? Like, because I'm getting the sense that maybe they're not ready, regardless of the way in which I would communicate. Like, they're just not a place where they want to get on the train and sort of go with you to wherever that point B is. I don't know if I've learned this over time or I'm more comfortable in my own skin in this regard, but I'll tell you what I love. I love reading the moment. There's something that's a high for me to just go, I would have never thought I would take it, gone in this direction. But I'm going because that's what the energy feels like. And that is, I'm not saying it's 100%, right? I'm not batting 1,000 or something. But more times than not, it allows enough oxygen in the room to kind of figure out sort of where that person is, you know, and how it's like I was getting ready to interview, I won't say his name, very recognizable American celebrity. And it's kind of a funny moment, but you know, it's already stressful enough, handlers and all this stuff. And the guy shows up and they'd like shut the door and we're like, we're kind of on a time. Like, what are we doing here? And one of the handlers comes out and says, you know what, we're going to have to wait here a little bit because he just was on the phone with his ex-wife and it did not go well. It was like some argument. And I thought, my great. Then I'm thinking, this is not even going to happen, right? So I just thought, you know, in my head, it was like, okay, that's a clear sign that this is not on the top of his list of what he wants to be doing. I wouldn't want it if I'm him, right? You're just emotionally charged up. And so I think I just took a different tact in just my energy with him to try to meet the moment in that way. And it went very well. And he was great. But I know that if I hadn't in that moment thought less about my own needs and kind of where he was potentially emotionally, I'm just making a guess, then it probably wouldn't have gone terribly well. Right. And then it would have felt like, God, I missed an opportunity there to capture a really, I think, interesting story. So I don't know if that answered your question, Michelle, but I guess when you get in front of people that much, I just think over time, you very quickly go, okay, this is the sensibility of that individual. And so I'm going to lightly go into it. Or it's like a celebrity again, I won't say the name, but the minute it was a remote interview, you know, it's known for his looks and everything like that. And I'm just like, I'm looking at him going, I've been known you as a celebrity since like the late 80s and you still look the same age or relative, you know. So I jokingly, right when we started, I made a comment about like, you know, like, tell me the truth about the hair, man. That's no way. That's beautiful. I wish I had mine was dark like that. And then he laughed and he sort of broke the ice immediately and we were able to take full advantage of our time. That's a huge risk, though.
Yeah.
So if I'm not conveying that as like, no, look, come on, man, this is a guy with gray hair talking, you know, that may not be received. So I probably trust my gut a lot more than I either acknowledge or even am aware of in the moment. But that's just because I've been a glutton for punishment and, you know, done so many of these.
Do you think actually, though, that that idea of reading the room or trusting your gut is really a form of listening?
Oh, that absolutely.
You're picking up on something. You're dialed into what's going on around you in a way that's giving you insight, which I think really that's what listening is. If we're paying attention to each other, it's not just your words, it's your mannerisms, it's how physically you seem to be engaging with the conversation. What's your body language? How are you oriented to me? Some people see that, some people don't. And maybe that's part of your success, is that you're listening to more things than the first person who spoke with Habib might have been in the course of that experience.
Maybe. Here's what I would say about that, Eric. I would say that I have found, and maybe this was the process of writing the book and just trying to distill down all the things I think we all take sort of our own skill sets for granted sometimes because we just don't have time. We do it. There's a great scene in Good Will Hunting where a mini driver's asking Matt Damon, you know, like in Harvard Square, how do you know? And he was like, well, do you play piano? And she's like, yeah, a bit. She says, a bit, you know, in her great sort of British accent, a bit. And he's like, you just know. And so I equate it to a little bit of that, but we don't think about it consciously, all the things we naturally are doing because we've just built up skills over time. But I think that it's not received well when we come in with an agenda. It's the agenda component that I think is what sort of puts blinders on for us, most people. You'll see this in the corporate space or in startup world or just sort of professional spaces where you think, wow, that leader, when I'm just chatting with him or her, I really enjoy them. But then when they speak in front of the room, it's like, are they tone deaf? They're missing like a substantial part of sort of the energy shared in this room. And then they're looking like, well, what's wrong, everybody? Or they don't say it. And then you feel like you create distance. I made a core mistake, and thank goodness I did it when I was a teenager. I was one of the lucky ones. I had a geometry teacher when I was 16 who, and I'm not saying this as like a point of pride or whatever. I probably would have had many more. I would have had a richer experience as a youth, but I obeyed the rules. I was a rule follower. I didn't get in trouble. I didn't party. I didn't do anything. I'm not advocating for that at all. You know, I should have sort of pushed the bounds and experienced my youth, I think, in a more appropriate way. So he plucked me out and said, I think, Rod, I think you could do some good in helping students that are struggling or whatever. So he got me into this nonprofit. And then he kept pushing me and like, you know, I want you to create a presentation. We're going to go to the school and I'm speaking in front of kids that are like older than me. And oh, here's a national competition for speaking. Go do that. He kept pushing me to do that. And I think over time those experiences helped me early on. Right. And so this one time, even when I think about it, I just go, like I'll have probably some minor sweats later on today just because I'm telling you this. I was asked to speak to a senior class the day before they went on spring break. So just sort of think about that for a second. I'm in an auditorium and I am like a year older than them. Like I had just graduated. And for whatever reason, I wasn't mature enough. I wasn't wise enough, maybe not even maturity. You know, how can I sort of put that on myself at that age? But I wasn't wise enough to know that regardless, if I'm not myself and I go in with an agenda, oh God, it's not going to go well. And it's probably one of the absolute worst professional experiences of my life because the audio went out. Like I tried to be something I wasn't. I tried to be funny. It was like, that's just not, it's not me. And I mean, it was just an absolute dressing down of my whatever ego I had, or I mean, it was awful. And I can't blame them. They're high school kids getting ready to go on their final spring break. Like they don't want to be hearing from me for an hour. But I will tell you, Michelle, like that was a lesson that I will never forget. And I think about whenever I'm going to do something that just feels like, wow, this is the first time I'm doing this. Like the hosting experience, that gala, you know, I can't, I mean, it's like this just a few days ago, right? I'm hosting this summit at these unbelievable climatologists and investors in climate tech. I mean, these are some really heady people. I can't compete with that, you know? And so if I avoid the agenda and I just live in the moment, you know, and I can just say that I earned it because that was such an awful experience because I tried to be something I wasn't, you know, whether a leader does that or a parent does that, we're so basic in our species. Like we pick that up and go, that's not, you know, I don't know, Eric, but I don't think that's his personality. I think he's trying too hard.
Michelle and I were having a conversation the other day about the idea of meeting somebody where they're at versus maybe pushing or pulling along. So you mentioned that you had this geometry teacher who pushing you is kind of seeing that there's capability in you and pushing you into different situations he thinks is going to be beneficial. And then you talk about there's that celebrity who has this negative interaction with his wife and you want to meet him where he's at. Not so related to what we've been talking to, but how do you see those two ideas reconciling themselves and recognizing when meeting where somebody's at is what the situation calls for versus the idea of, wait a second, I got to pull you along a little bit because you can get somewhere further than you might think.
I think the first thing that comes to mind is an awareness of our impact on other people around us and their impact on us. It's like, it's such a subtle thing that I think we could do a better job of in raising youth, young people to understand sort of their footprint. We'll talk about, you know, and that may be an overused term, but I do think it's an apt term because there are a lot of times where you think, okay, you know that it's a pretty basic equation. You know, you get dropped into some environment and it's either you're new to it, whatever it is. And like, what's the reverberation? Like what's, you know, how is the energy spiking or not based on your inclusion in that? I mean, look, I've had examples where you just go, okay, that's a severe example that most people don't have, but it sort of bears out. I mean, I made a decision, again, why I did it, I have no idea. So when I'm on that trip to Senegal, and when I travel to capture stories, I am not a tourist at all. Like I am to the point where being a tourist now in my personal life, it makes it harder because it doesn't feel as authentic, right? I love the rawness of it. But I had this experience where these young people deep in the bush, they had looked at me in a way that I'd never experienced in my life. And I was told that there was a high likelihood I was the first white face they had seen in person. I mean, you sort of like, how do you, an incredible moment, just a moment that on your deathbed, you think, I just want that to flash in front of my eyes because that's so rare. And so it immediately sparked in me something that just said, I want to know more. I don't want to come in here being sort of ignorant to me being in a world that is very different than my own. And I don't want to come across like I have some answer or I'm better than, because that's not it at all. And so I started asking around and wanted to know what people called people with white faces in that part of the world. And I, to the chagrin and like freak out of some people that were like, oh my gosh, I can't believe he said that. I would use that to my advantage, not as like I'm trying to take advantage or manipulate a situation at all, but just to say like, as almost like a peace offering or as an offering to say like, I'm in your space. I want to respect your space, right?
A means of connection.
Yeah. And when I would do that, the responses were fantastic. I've never had a bad response. Ever. I was in an Uber in Calgary a few weeks ago, and the gentleman, I knew immediately, I'm like, I think he's from Ethiopia, right? And so of course I'm like loving this because we're going to chat now and I'm like this 35-40 minute ride. And we talked about, you know, being a Mzungu in Eastern Africa. And all of a sudden his entire life story as a refugee just sort of just unfurled right there in that car. And it was like, okay, so it's this notion of like, okay, this guy gets it, or at least he's at least saying, hey, look, I'm vulnerable here. I'm like, I just want to. And so for me, that taught me so much about the impact that there's sort of that intended, right? Impact, what you intend to do, and the things that probably you don't, but they weigh even heavier, right? And so always thinking about like, what's my role? Like, what do I represent? Right? I'm over in the Nordics and everybody's talking about what's going on in America. Like, what happened to you guys? That's really basically the tenet of the conversations. And I know in those tiny moments, I don't represent 340 million people, but to a point for them, I do, because they want to know, like, help go inside. Is this what we're really experiencing, what we see in the news, or, you know, kind of give us the flavor. And so I really try to work on like, what's my impact in that space? And even if I don't have the answer, the fact, I feel like people can pick up that energy. Like, he doesn't know. And I like that. He's not the know-it-all. He's going, God, I'm an idiot. I don't know. Right. I'm talking about myself.
Say, I don't know. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. If you say, I don't know, like I'm at a loss for words. I don't know what this, how this is going to work out. And so, yeah, that's been an amazing experience. A little over a year ago, I was in Tanzania in a very remote part of the country on this hillside with this grandmother that walks like 6 hours a day to get water for her grandkids. Through the translator, I said, before we start rolling on camera and stuff, I told the translator, I said, you know, please share with her that, you know, this Mzungu is just so honored, right, and appreciative of her time. And she said to me, you want me to say that? I said, yes. And she did. And that grandmother, it was just like a melting of whatever preconceived notion she probably had about me, which I wouldn't fault her for. And we just had this amazing sort of conversation, even through a translator, you know. And to me, that's like, okay, you know, don't go in with an agenda. Understand the perspective that others may have about you and what you represent, and that's okay. And just try to go into it humbly, and you're going to be, more often than not, I think you're going to be received quite well.
You said you had this back and forth for 35, 40 minutes. In the car, do you ever wish your brain and your curiosity could turn off and you can have a silent car ride or not ask questions? I know when I'm getting into a car or an Uber, I want my brain to be turned off. So do you ever feel like that can turn off, or are you always naturally curious?
I'm pretty much always. And it's actually like a drug in this regard. I've never done drugs, but this, I would imagine, is something where it's just this addiction. It's returning your rental car where you go over the spikes and you can't back up at the airport. Because like in that moment, in that conversation, I felt so alive because we had a point of connection. I knew that part of the world. I knew what he was talking about, how he had been displaced and didn't see his mother for 16 years. Right. And I'd known so many people like that. And so, I mean, that's like it's an amazing connection that it wasn't in the calendar. I didn't select it in my Uber, like UberX is what you're going to get, you know? And so when you have those, and I'll say this too, Michelle, I'm a yes person. And I'm sure it's not been in my favor in the past, but I'd like to think I'm batting above what they would say is the Mendoza line, or I'm, you know, it's a healthy batting average, because more often than not, I get to have an experience through a short story that is so informative and honest that's the addiction. And if I don't take that chance, man, I miss out, you know? And if I hadn't said the trip to Senegal happened, I got this random email on a Sunday and I thought it was spam, but I recognized the name as like this well-known publicist. And I thought, I've never talked with this individual. Is this fake? Well, I sort of went down the rabbit hole and it wasn't fake. And I ended up weeks later in Senegal with a sort of life-changing experience working on capturing stories about battling child marriage for girls, you know, and that's because I say yes, you know, so.
The question I want to leave you with today is a question that we like to ask on this podcast. Can you think of a time where you got to become a part of somebody's story, or somebody became a part of your story in a way that was memorable or impactful for you? Kind of the analogy we use is our patients with hearing loss, maybe whether it's hearing aids or cochlear implants, kind of being a part of their journey to hear again. That gets to be a really moving part of what we do. So I'm curious in your experiences around the world where that's happened for you.
Wow. I mean, you guys are doing the real work, right? I mean, just me sort of capturing and witnessing and whether I'm putting it on paper or into a microphone, what I'm observing and hopefully telling a story or sharing a story doesn't compare to what you guys are doing, because those moments are absolutely, I mean, you see them online, or if, you know, my old world, you would hear about these things through colleagues. Like I need to get that out there. That's the real work. So audience, please don't take what I'm doing as that this is the transformational work. So nothing that I could share would compare to that. I'd like to think, but see, I would also say to this, Eric, maybe my experience with other people or those shared moments impacted them in ways where they couldn't put words to it, or in the moment they couldn't, and I will never see them again. So I don't know. I know that I selfishly, of course, have had experiences where I just think, that's a one of one. It's just a one of one. And sometimes it's the moments that I've missed, right? We've been talking about all these things that where I've hit the ball, or I've, you know, what I sort of feel like I've scored the touchdown or something like that. But I mean, in the book, I talk about this gentleman, Mawa Emanuel, who was, I think, 25 or 26 at the refugee camp. He'd been there for 6 years. His entire family had been slaughtered other than he and his mother. His mother couldn't take the camp anymore, and she went back to South Sudan. And he, at that point, didn't know what you know, had become of her. And he was too old at that point to stay in school at the refugee camp. So he's an absolute, he's the definition of living in purgatory. Mm-hmm. There's nowhere for him to go, and he wants to be a medical doctor. And I missed an opportunity to do a follow-up, like just sitting with him in shared space. And I will absolutely regret that till the day I die, that I did not. There was something so powerful in his eyes that I wanted to, you know more about. And that was one of the reasons that I had to, of course, write about him in the book, because it's just, you know, they're the stories that you didn't capture, you didn't ask. So the list is long of the things that have been impactful for me, but that's just me being stupid lucky and falling into opportunities where hopefully I've met the moment. And, you know, so I would never claim that I've done anything that's been earth shattering in that regard. I will, you know what? It did make me think about one thing. Okay, this does not, but briefly, back in my old sort of clinical days, there was a young man who everybody just assumed was autistic, and he went through every clinic. You know, this was out in California back when they were giving 40 hours of therapy for families. Free, 40 hours a week. And, you know, I'm young and like whatever, and I'm curious and asking questions. And I asked enough questions, but also made sure to say, look, like this is not my expertise, is not ophthalmology or a dietitian, but I just need a full picture of this kid. Long story short, my gut told me he had not had a sufficient eye exam, and that maybe these behaviors that were being exhibited had much more to do with a severe issue with his vision. And I was right. And the kid was not autistic. So I can feel really good that, you know, and I was in no position to sort of push as hard as I did, but I did with my supervisors. I said, please trust me. I know there's no reason for you to trust me. And it worked. And it was right. And so that kid's life changed in that regard, right? And he'll never know.
Unless he's listening.
I don't know if he will. I would never hold him to that. Yeah, you know, but 9 out of 10 times.
That's surreal. Wow.
Well, I mean, it's just being annoying, right? I was just curious, like, look, guys, you know, but, you know, again, it's if we look, we don't, sometimes I think we live in a bubble. It's like, well, I'm only going to ask you these questions because this is my area. And it's like, no, we are all humans. Make a wild guess, you know, mm-hmm. Oh, okay, well, you're eating junk food until midnight on Sundays, and then you're going to school and your energy's off, and now you're behavioral, you know, some of it's not rocket science, but I think we get to a point where we have to be specialized to think we have value in this world. And it's like, no, you have value because you're a human and your story counts and it matters.
And that is the true value of your work. Thank you so much for coming on today. I feel like I'm coming out wiser from this. From your words, this is what you do best, of sharing stories, sharing your insight. Why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you, where they can find your work, how they can connect with you?
Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this conversation. You guys are pros and you're really good at listening, which obviously because of your work, it's near and dear to you in that way. Look, drrodberger.com, they can go to pre-order the book. I never understood the publishing world and how that worked, but pre-orders are very important in a world that's scored by algorithms and books that will be on the bookshelves. But yeah, it's going to hit bookstores. Or if you order it now, I think it hits your front door November 18th. Bookstores, physical bookstores will be November 12th. But all my socials are all Dr. Rod Berger. So just DrRodBerger. And if you go to my website, you can hit Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all those guys. And I love when people reach out. So I would encourage you, please, I learn from people that, and I've made great friendships just from cold inbound. Someone heard something, read something, and you develop a friendship. And that to me is about connection. So I appreciate the time on your show, and I encourage people to continue to follow you guys. You're doing a really great thing.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to have you on.